Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
This is The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval in Hobart for the Tasmania Book Prizes to be awarded later today. But for now, be very afraid as we're walking on the dark side of our literary history as we delve into the depths of our own melancholic and brooding and often horrific Gothic fiction. The screenplay to the movie The Proposition was written by our very own Bard of Darkness, Nick Cave. The movie dramatises the brutality of early settlement in Australia. It's a tale of guns and murder, of shocking violence between outlaws and the police and against Aboriginal people. But it's also set in a stark, eerily poetic landscape. This violent history has been explored not only in film but in fiction as well, from the early colonial writers like Marcus Clarke and Henry Lawson to the late Elizabeth Jolly and Peter Carey. The Australian landscape has been transformed into a menacing character in Gothic tales of colonisation and displacement. Just think of Picnic at Hanging Rock, in which the dangers of the Australian bush really do seem to come alive. But what comes to mind when you think of the Gothic? Is it the European vision of ravens and Frankenstein and gargoyles and dark, foggy, cobbled streets? Or are you haunted by bunyips and the desert? Well, the underbelly of the Australian psyche will be exposed today on The Book Show in our panel discussion on the Australian Gothic literature. What I want to know is what makes it particularly Australian. And to guide us on this literary journey from the dungeons of Port Arthur to the story of Joanne Lee's terrifying experience on the road in the Australian outback, we're joined by gurus of the Gothic, I'll call them. Ken Gelder, Professor of Literary Studies at Melbourne University. He's currently putting together an anthology of Australian Gothic writing. Rachel Weaver, who's the author of The Criminal of the Century, a 19th century true crime, and she's currently co-editing the anthology of colonial Australian Gothic fiction with Ken, and Jerry Turcott, who's dean in the School of Arts and Sciences at the University of Notre Dame, who's looking at the similarities and differences between Australia and Canada, two countries with a British colonial past. Hello to everybody on The Book Show this morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Now, I might just ask you to just turn down your headphones because I can hear myself back in one of your headphones because I'm in a completely different city to all of you. That's probably a bit better. Now, I'd just like to ask you each to just tell me quickly what attracts you to the subject of the Gothic, because it is very dark and veers into horror sometimes, and I've even scared myself with the introduction. Rachel, why are you attracted to the Gothic?
I'm not sure why I've always had such a gruesome turn of mind. I think people always think it's at odds with the rest of my personality, but for as long as I can remember, Edgar Allan Poe and the Irish writer from the first half of the 19th century, Sheridan Le Fanu, have been amongst my favourite authors. I love A Haunted House, and The Fall of the House of Usher is probably my favourite story of all time.
What about you, Ken?
Oh, I don't know, really. I don't know. Something to do with my childhood, perhaps. I guess, but I think I was an immigrant to Australia as a boy, coming from England, and grew up in an outer suburb that was very bleak. And I was drawn, even at an early age, to a sense that houses, even those very new houses that got built for English immigrants in outer suburbs, were haunted in some way. I had a strong sense of possession and hauntedness even as a boy, and I think that stayed with me to a degree.
What about you, Jerry, from Canada originally?
Well, I'm a French-Canadian Catholic, so the Gothic for me was sort of the everyday. And
What do you mean?
Well, I grew up, next to a church that had a crucifix that, would sort of be shadowed onto my bed in the morning, and I'd wake up and put up the blind, and the neighbours would be looking and saying, "You should be in church." And so the whole sense of the Gothic and that sense of its connection to, of course, all the great Gothic churches in Montreal made it feel very ordinary to me. The Gothic is all around us, and that's what makes it so fascinating, I think.
Well, while you're talking, Jerry, and before we get into the Australian setting, what are the origins of the Gothic style?
Well, there are a lot of different views on this, but in terms of the literary, one of the popular wisdoms is that the Castle of Otranto by Horace Walpole is sort of gives us the beginning or the lineaments of Gothic fiction, and it's a very humble, very tiny book, which is actually a hoot to read nowadays. But it begins that whole tradition of bringing a type of haunted ancestry and medieval knights and portraits that get up and walk and so forth into popular fiction, if you will. And it just gets increasingly elaborated upon, certainly in the British context, which is what I began with. We just see this develop as a initially, you know, Gothic just meant medieval. And as it develops, it begins to mean spectral and horrific and so on and so forth. So the Gothic has very humble origins, and then it continues as a sort of much maligned but secretly loved form, you know, from then on.
So Mary Shelley takes up the whatever they take up in the Gothic, the cudgel or something.
Yeah, very powerful Victorian Gothic with her, but you know, also very powerful predecessors like Anne Radcliffe and Monk Lewis, and you know that just that wonderful sort of excess and that the genre still manages to trade in.
Well, let's get to Australia now. Ken Gelder, what are the factors that established a particularly Australian vision of the Gothic, do you think?
Well, it came to Australia as an imported genre that was already well developed in Britain and Europe, and of course had gone to the United States, had gone to America through Edgar Allan Poe and Nathaniel Hawthorne in the 1830s, 1840s. For us, the first identifiably Australian Gothic fiction happened in the 1850s, 1860s, so it kind of follows on pretty hot on the heels of Edgar Allan Poe, and I think those American influences are actually very strong in some of the early Australian Gothic fiction. But by the time you get to the 1880s, 1890s, there's a really flourishing sense of what we call a colonial Australian Gothic.
And Rachel, you're putting together with Ken an anthology on the colonial Gothic. What examples have you come across from this time?
Well, we've had a great time putting together this collection, Ramona. We've started it off with John Lang's The Ghost Upon the Rail, which is an 1859 story about a myth that circulates still in Australia about Fisher's ghost. And it ends as late as 1932 with Catherine Susanna Pritchard's lovely little story, The Curse. We've included some authors that are probably quite well known to readers. Henry Lawson's The Bush Undertaker is in there. But I think by including it amongst these Gothic stories, maybe it gives a bit of a fresh perspective on a story that's been otherwise canonised as kind of Australian realism. It gives it its popular roots back in a way. We've also included a Clarke story, The Mystery of Major Molyneux. Readers will be familiar with Clarke's The Term of His Natural Life, which is a very famous Gothic novel of convict transportation. I'm not sure if people will be familiar with Rosa Prade. She was a literary celebrity in her day. She grew up in Queensland, came from the kind of Queensland squatocracy, and ended up living in London and mixing with people like Oscar Wilde and other famous writers there. We've included her story, The Bunyip, which is the story of early colonial settlement. It draws on Aboriginal myths of the Bunyip, but turns it into a very distinctly white kind of fear and anxiety in the alien bush landscape. Barbara Bainton may be another familiar one too.
What about what they were writing about? There seems to be a sort of an underbelly of a response to the violence between the white settlers and Aborigines.
Yes, well, some of the stories that we've included in the anthology literally take that up. Ernest Favink is a not-so-well-known writer who was an explorer and journalist in the mid and late 19th century. He wrote many stories for the Bulletin, and his story, Doomed, is literally a story that looks at graphic violence between Aboriginal and settler people and takes that up in a very Gothic way with, you know, ghastly spectres returning to avenge upon the white settlers.
Now, Gerry, you've actually said that the Gothic imagination of Australia started before it was even colonised. What do you mean by that?
I think I'm talking about the way, if you look at the pre-discovery of the continent, the landmass is sort of imagined into being long before it's even found, and you can see this through the medieval maps that posit what might be living here, and some of the wonderful monstrous images in the margins of all these great maps that say, you know, this is what an Antipodean will look like. And I think that whole tradition of really inventing what you're going to find before you find it is quite commonplace. And then you have that very strange situation where when you finally do find the thing you've imagined, it doesn't quite conform to what you had invented, and then you get quite grumpy about it. And so a lot of these texts sort of negotiate that sense of expectation or disappointment. I think that's also a very interesting aspect that the Gothic can bring to light, if you will.
You've looked at the similarities between Canadian and Australian Gothic literature, both with colonial pasts, both with violence against Indigenous people. Do the Gothic writings reflect the similarity, or are they expressed in different ways?
I think there are certainly differences, but the similarities are quite spooky, if I can be allowed to use those terms. And I think they reflect that sense in terms of early colonialism of that uncertainty about the landscape that you're interacting with, that sense that you aren't, you know, legitimately of a place, and you somehow have to account for these Indigenous peoples that are there. And the early colonial texts negotiate that in quite remarkable ways, imagining really the Gothic monstrosity often as being the Aboriginal presence. Some early remarkable books challenge that. In Canada, Richardson's Wakusta is a novel where, after you've feared this sort of Indigenous figure, you discover that he's in fact a British lord who's sort of been cross-dressing, if you will, or racially passing as an Indigenous figure. So I think the relationship is very complicated about how you talk about your own place in the new world, how what it is that you're afraid of in that new world, and how you then choose metaphors to talk about it in your fiction.
Well, it's obviously very fitting that I'm broadcasting from Tasmania this morning. It certainly captured the Gothic imagination with a convict past, with Port Arthur, for example, and this brutal world was taken up as a theme in more contemporary works like Richard Flanagan's Gould's Book of Fish. But there seems to be, there are examples of the colonial being used in recent literature as well as Gould's Book of Fish, aren't there? Kate Grenville, perhaps.
Well, I think Kate Grenville's always been obsessed with the Gothic. One of her earliest books, Dream House, is a delightful book set in Tuscany, and it's specifically a Gothic text. It has, again, to use that phrase, all the lineaments of Gothic fiction, you know, the brooding, terrifying husband. But it begins to be turned towards a type of feminist purpose. I mean, in the end, there's a type of emancipation of the figure. But she also, you know, follows that through in Lillian's story, Dark Places, and, Secret River, and so forth.
Now, Ken, one of the early Australian writers who wrote about the Gothic landscape was Marcus Clarke. I think you've got something you can read of his that shows how he imagined the landscape.
Well, Marcus Clarke's been kind of influential, I think, in giving us a trope, I think, through which to imagine the colonial Gothic, or even through which to evoke it. And he wrote a very famous preface to an 1876 collection of poetry by Adam Lindsay Gordon, who by that time had been dead for some years. Adam Lindsay Gordon had shot himself. He was a poet, a very, very good horseman, a gambler, and he shot himself, I think, about 6 years before. So these poems came out posthumously. So Marcus Clarke writes the preface to these poems, these collected poems of Adam Lindsay Gordon's, and thinks about that the national characteristics of colonial Australian poetry. How can you think about it? But all in the context of Adam Lindsay Gordon having committed suicide. So you get this quite kind of dark atmosphere about the kinds of speculations Clarke is engaging with in this preface. And he turns to Edgar Allan Poe, so you get that American Gothic influence, and has a think about the connection between Poe and Australian poetry, colonial Australian poetry, and comes up with this phrase, weird melancholy. And he takes it from Poe and applies it to the Australian bush landscape. And he writes towards the end of this preface, writes a passage that just seems to get amazingly carried away with itself, and it goes like this. The Australian mountain forests are funereal, secret, and stern. Their solitude is desolation. They seem to stifle in their black gorges a story of sullen despair. In the Australian forests, no leaves fall. The savage winds shout among the rock clefts. From the melancholy gums, strips of white bark hang and rustle. The very animal life of these frowning hills is either grotesque or ghostly. Great grey kangaroos hop noiselessly over the coarse grass. Flights of white cockatoos stream out, shrieking like evil souls. The sun suddenly sinks, and the mopokes burst out into horrible peals of semi-human laughter. The natives aver that when night comes from out of the bottomless depth of some lagoon, the bunyip rises and in form like monstrous sea calf drags his loathsome length from out the ooze. From a corner of the silent forest rises a dismal chant, and around a fire dance natives painted like skeletons.
Well, it's very, very creepy, but it makes me think that the only person who could describe the Australian bush like that is for someone who wasn't from here, who expected it to be different, because, you know, who expects kangaroos to make noise? I mean, if you know anything about them, they'll just, you know, being silent is kind of normal, isn't it?
We have one colonial Gothic writer in our anthology who talks about the wild jackass in the Australian bush, so there is a sense that there's a lot of kind of imported animal effects and oral effects and so on that are coming, as I say, often from the American Gothic. But yeah, I mean, this is a partly imported and partly local, and there is a negotiation between the two things in the colonial Australian Gothic.
So Jerry, how is the landscape imagined in Canadian Gothic? Does it contrast with Australia? Because, I mean, we're afraid of the big, hot, dry centre desert thing, and you guys are, well, where you used to come from, the people there who are still there are afraid of the cold, icy innards, aren't they?
Yeah, look, I think you just transpose it onto the place where you're not. So, you know, for Canadians, 85% of them live along the border that's shared with the US, and therefore they project their fears onto the frozen north, to which 95% have never been, or more than that, and the same is here. So I think often the thing you fear is the thing you haven't been to. It's really more of a type of strategic space to use symbolically to talk about the things that you fear. The thing that's very interesting about, you know, colonial Gothic is that it plays quite a few roles, but two of them are that in one way it's a way of sort of naturalizing your space by talking about it in terms that are established and familiar. So the Gothic genre was familiar, and to talk about it and to set it up in terms of those tropes of the Gothic, to use Ken's term, is a way of saying that, you know, we can transpose these familiar spaces onto the local space. But also it's a way to say and to refute the sense that there was no history here. So, you know, Marcus Clarke was very keen to use these Gothic tropes, to transpose them onto things like convictism and to say, hang on, we do have a history here, and here it is, it's local and so forth. Canada does the same thing. It uses those spaces and finds a way to say, look, they're natural, they're terrifying, and we build garrisons, to use Northrop Frye's famous phrase, you know, that garrison mentality where you stay inside the walls of the fort and you fear what's outside of it. And the Gothic becomes a type of language, which is maybe even a passport to cross between those two worlds, sometimes in safety. You know, I mean, the Gothic is often a type of safety valve to talk about the taboo, the feared, and so forth.
Well, Rachel, the Gothic can be funny too, which is a relief after all this very menacing talk. For instance, even though Henry Lawson's work doesn't fit neatly into the Gothic genre, there are elements there in The Bush Undertaker, aren't there, of humour?
Yeah, on the whole, the story is a really bleak one, which kind of hinges on the isolation of this strange hermit-like figure of the Bush Undertaker he's a shepherd who spends his time as a kind of body farmer, digging up corpses and burying them again in his spare time. He finds corpses in the landscape, and then one of them he recognises, it's the corpse of a shearer that he'd known, and he decides to take it home. He makes a buck stretcher for it. And although the story is really bleak, it at times it approaches a kind of almost slapstick gothic where the corpse falls on him from behind and he rushes forward thinking he's being attacked, and then has to turn around and realise that it's this corpse with its bark covering, slipping down and showing its decomposing face. So the gothic can also risk becoming humorous at times because it's so melodramatic. It can inadvertently parody itself by trying to reinforce its own emotional intensity, but that doesn't happen with Lawson. I think it's kind of almost the opposite of that, where it shows this really barren world and everything's really strange and understated, but so when humour kind of works there, it's much more poignant than kind of ridiculous, which you can sometimes get with European forms of gothic.
Well, just maybe just a safety valve or a relief valve.
Possibly,
for the tension.
Yeah.
Well, on ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Book Show. I'm Ramona Koval, and today we're delving into the melancholic, the brooding and the dark side of Australian literature. My guests in this discussion about Australian Gothic literature are Ken Gelder, who's Professor of Literary Studies at Melbourne University, Rachel Weaver, who wrote Criminal of the Century, and Professor Jerry Turcotte from the University of Notre Dame. Let's turn now to the city. We've done the bush. Well, let's turn now to the city and ask how it's been imagined in Gothic writing, because Patrick White has a considerable Gothic pedigree. Here's an example of the city in his book Riders in the Chariot.
The train was easing through the city, which knives had sliced open to serve up with all the juices running, red and green and purple. All the syrups of the sundaes oozing into the streets to sweeten. The neon syrup coloured the pools of vomit and the sailors' piss. By that light, the eyes of the younger gabardine men were a blinding, blinder blue, were not actually burnt out. The blue-haired grannies had purple from the roots of their hair down to the angles of their pants, not for shame, but neon as their breasts chafed to escape from chamois leather back to youth, or else roundly asserted themselves like chamber pots in concrete.
My goodness me, that's the sort of city you don't want to be near very often. That's from Patrick White's Riders in the Chariot, and the language he uses, it's very horrific. You know, the train is slicing and it's like the entrails of the city are oozing out. The city in this vision is really like a monster. But Jerry, to what extent does the city feature in Australian Gothic writing?
I think it's a big part of it. One of my favourite quotes, and I'm just going from memory, but The Eye of the Storm, I think it is, where Patrick White has a writer who announces grandly that he's looking at how to adapt the Gothic to local conditions. I think the city begins, both in the Canadian and the Australian context, to look at, I guess, all those dark secrets that are hidden behind closed doors. Alice Munro, who's quite a famous short story writer in Canada, talks about the Gothic linoleum caves of everyday kitchens where all these horrors take place. And the horrors are psychological ones. They're pressures against people for roles that they are or aren't performing and so forth. So the city starts to increasingly be figured as a Gothic space. It used to be that, you know, you had to go out into the wilderness. Suddenly writers begin to realize that the wilderness is here, it's all around us, and perhaps that we are equally Gothic in our movements every day. And I think this gives a lovely edginess to contemporary Australian writing that recognizes the monstrous you know, as being quite quotidian and not extraordinary, or that the monster can be within us.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think Ken and both Ken and Rachel said at the beginning what attracted them to the Gothic, and they mentioned houses, you know, haunted houses, and we really just don't have those kinds of haunted gargoyle encrusted. We haven't got that architecture in the city, have we, to make it Gothic?
Ironically, for me, the thing that got me into the Gothic in Australia was walking up. I was going to say straight off the boat, but of course I flew. But I was, you know, just arrived in Australia in 1986, walking up towards Sydney University and looked up, and there was this big kangaroo gargoyle looking at me. And I went to an exhibition, and there was a chair commissioned by Governor Macquarie, which was in the Gothic style but covered in kangaroo skin. And that's what started me thinking about this notion of how you transpose the sort of standard Gothic into new forms, and it became very attractive. And talking to a stonemason, I was told that many of the early convicts who were sort of co-opted into doing repairs building sandstone buildings were deliberately miscutting it so that it would crumble, so that you would have this wonderful rebellion being acted out maybe, you know, 200 years later. And I guess all these sorts of ideas gelled around the way that the Gothic is all around you in the sort of physicality of the buildings and landscapes. And I thought it was, you know, absolutely intriguing.
And then from the suburbs, there's also that genre of books set in rural towns, like Kenneth Cook's Wake in Fright. Can you describe this story and its significance?
Well, it's a good generic story, this one, because, I mean, one of the classic modern Gothic forms is to map out the journey away from the city and into the country, and to cast that as a journey of horror and terror. This is a story about someone who makes exactly that journey, and we see it played out. In fact, we saw it just recently played out with Joanne Lees. We saw it also played out in the film Wolf Creek, and that's the Gothic sliding into a fairly straight horror fiction or horror cinema, I guess. But we see it also in Mad Max. If you think about that journey out of the city and into a very particular kind of Australian outback, where the country town is passed very, very quickly. You just drive straight through it, and that's its weirdness. And you drive on very, very straight roads. I mean, we sometimes have a sense of the urban Gothic really as a kind of convoluted, rather meandering form that evokes a congested a city with one building upon another building. But Mad Max is kind of about very flat, open landscapes and very, very straight roads. And I think the director of those Mad Max films, George Miller, had once said that the straightness of the roads is the Gothic effect, that you can be hit by an oncoming car that you can't see, even though you should be able to see it. And he talked a lot about the way the modern Australian Gothic is, if it has a weapon of horror that evokes horror, it's the car, it's the automobile. That's our killing machine in modern Australia.
Well, this is The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval, and we're talking about the influence of Australian Gothic literature today on the Australian psyche. Now, Rachel, your research into, we talked about the Joanne Lees story. I hope we can get to that in a moment. But your research into the crime of Frederick Bailey Deeming in the late 19th century in Melbourne, it's very much about the city, isn't it? But it's a true case. Tell us about that case.
Well, the Deeming case was an incredibly sensational crime that occurred in 1892. In March that year, the naked body of a woman was found under the hearthstone of this ordinary suburban house in Windsor. And from the moment the body was uncovered, it created this intense media sensation in Melbourne, which only increased as the search for the murderer proceeded. It turned out that he was a bigamist and a con man and a jewel thief and an international criminal, world-class export-quality criminal that Australia was very excited to have. And it turned out that he'd actually not only murdered this woman but an entire family and another wife in Rainhill near Liverpool, which he also buried beneath the floor of a dingy villa just on the outskirts of this small village. And Deeming was compared it became an international media sensation, and he was compared to Jack the Ripper, who'd completed his killings 4 years earlier in 1888 in London. And Jack the Ripper was a criminal who was really synonymous with the city, with the kind of dark laneways of London. And in a way, Deeming became that for Melbourne. He conferred a kind of cosmopolitan danger on the metropolis. And Deeming was, in fact, thought to be Jack the Ripper by many people.
So did this feed into the literary sensibility, this case?
It certainly did. It manifested itself in all kinds of popular culture. There was a play put on about the case at the time of the trial, so that people could go to the trial in the daytime and watch the events unfolding there, and then see them reenacted that night at the Alexandra Theatre with Alfred Dampier's theatre company performing the murder on stage. So that was a very gothic kind of reenactment of the crimes. There were also numerous exhibitions at the Bourke Street Waxworks, which itself was a very macabre space because it had an anatomical museum attached to it that was full of abnormal organs and kind of mutilated body parts. There were also numerous books published the year of the trial, about four non-fiction books, which were just histories of the case. And there was also it was rewritten as a gothic romance called Frederick Bailey Deeming, A Romance of Crime.
Well, you know, then there's, of course, the modern story of Joanne Lees broadcast on TV this week. But, you know, these stories do contribute to other kinds of forms, like that deeply spooky movie Wolf Creek seems to feed into the fear that cases like Joanne Lees experience heightens. But it takes a step further into horror. Let's hear an excerpt from Wolf Creek to end. I hope you don't scare easily, and it has got a rude word in it, but that's the least of its problems.
There's something out there.
And it ain't no man.
No, I saw some lights.
Where?
Right there. There.
What the hell? No, don't.
There might be a car.
Well, it might not be a car. And that don't look like no car.
It's coming this way.
It is coming this way.
Fuck. Should we run?
No, just stay in the car. Don't move. Hang on, it's a car.
Well, how do you know?
It's a bloody car. I can hear the engine.
Well, very, very scary. But look, I've been scared all morning, but you've helped me by talking to me so cleverly about the Australian Gothic. Thank you all for coming on the book show today. Ken Gelder, Professor of Literary Studies at Melbourne University, who's currently putting together an anthology of colonial Australian Gothic fiction with Rachel Weaver. And Rachel Weaver is also the author of The Criminal of the Century, a 19th century true crime. And Jerry Turcotte is Dean in the School of Arts and Sciences at the University of Notre Dame. Thank you all for being on the book show with me.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Now, thanks this week go to the producers of the book show, Rhiannon Brown, Sarah Lestrange, Maria Zylstra and Michael Sheriffs, and sound maestro Paul Penton. On Sunday's book show, after the news at 7 p.m, an erotic program with repressed sexuality. We'll hear again about why there's an erotic poem, The Song of Songs, in the middle of the book of the Old Testament. And we'll hear again from John Spence, the man who wrote the book on which the film Becoming Jane was based, charting the short progression of a passion in Jane Austen's life. I'm off now to chair the awards ceremony for the Tasmanian Book Prizes here in Hobart, and I'll tell you all about the winners on Monday. You can go to the website abc.net.au/rn/bookshow, where you can download our program as an MP3 podcast, and you can find out all sorts of stuff there. Have a fantastic weekend. See you Monday.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.